meager beginnings as an adolescent ambulance washer in Moose Jaw, Saskatchewan, to a decade-long legacy of bringing you breaking news before it makes the news, broadcasting live from the studios of Scared Monkeys Radio Network via C-band satellite W3-957, Access Communications Channel 7, and worldwide via digital streaming audio at ScaredMonkeysRadio.com, it's the Dana Pretzer Show. And now, your host, Dana Pretzer.
Okay, good evening, everyone. We're going to start with a case about Kaylee. No, it's not Kaylee Anthony. We're actually going to get into that case a little bit later on tonight. About Kaylee Rain. Now, this is a very important story that I want everybody to sit down and pay close attention to. And write this website down or go to this website as you're listening, whether you're listening live or you're listening on the podcast. Moms, M-O-M-S, for justice.org. That's simple. MomsForJustice.org. This story was featured on Dr. Phil in 2006, and a shocking conclusion was aired in December 2008. SAVE, S-A-V-E, Kaylee, is a not-for-profit organization founded by Bonnie DeJazik, I hope I pronounced that right, in response to her family's experience with the judicial system. Bonnie DeJazik and her daughter came to believe that her two-year-old granddaughter, Kaylee's biological father, was sexually abusing her. Their suspicions were confirmed when Kaylee was brought into the ER after midnight while on visitation by her father. She was bleeding from a 2-centimeter tear in her labia. Ultimately, the system did not respond to protect this child. Instead, the system chose to protect the father's rights to access to the child. It's a shocking story, and I want to welcome tonight, I want to welcome Bonnie, I want to welcome her attorney, James Boardman, and Joe Jordan, you'll know as a guest on this program, who's a victim's advocate and someone who's behind the Save Kaylee organization and Moms for Justice. Welcome all.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Good evening, Dana.
Let's start with Joe Jordan. Welcome back to the program, by the way. As a victim's advocate, you sent me a picture the other day of Kaylee, and you said, here's the girl that I'm wanting to help save. And by God, you know, when you see an angelic little face like that on the screen, if that isn't reason enough, besides what we're doing here to grab this bull by the horns and do something with it, I don't know what is. What are your thoughts?
And that's exactly what it's about. It's not about anything else except these children that are being pulled victim to this system, and to these people that think that it's okay to sexually abuse them and to rape them. And myself having a 2-year-old daughter, I think that's what relates well. And with my past, with my sister involved in a similar case, I think this is something that I feel very strongly about, and I've always, since been enlightened to, have felt strongly about, and will continue to pursue child's rights over father's rights, as long as I'm alive.
It's a mixed-up system we've got. It's a good system, but it's a mixed-up one. We'll get to the attorney a little bit later. But Bonnie DeJazik, I hope I'm pronouncing that right. When you go to the website, momsforjustice.org, and read it, and I encourage you all to, there's a couple of clips from the Dr. Phil show, and I tell you, those tug at your heartstrings for sure. Tell us about yourself. How are you related to Kaylee?
I am Kaylee's biological grandmother. Kaylee's mother, Krista, is my daughter.
And when you, as a grandparent, and I don't give a darn, you know, for the listeners, if you're a parent, grandparent, cousin, uncle, you know, friend, when you hear about something like this, when you see the video of what the little girl has to say, it must have just tore your heart right in half. Let's talk a little bit about the video and how you first heard about Kaylee and the abuse to her.
Well, actually, how it all started was on Kaylee's second birthday, my daughter Krista decided to send an invitation to Kaylee's father. He had not seen her basically for about a year and a half. And Krista thought it'd be nice to involve him in Kaylee's life, so she sent him and his current girlfriend a birthday invitation. He did show up, and so did his girlfriend, at the party. And during the party, he was at first very subtle by feeding Kaylee cake.
Mm-hmm.
Well, a few people noticed and said something, that he was feeding Kaylee cake with his tongue.
God.
Sticking his tongue in her mouth with the cake. And we quickly called Kaylee to get off his lap. We thought that was very strange.
Right.
And then we continued on with the party. Well, a little ways into the party, Kaylee had disappeared. And Chris is like, where's Kaylee? Everybody started looking for Kaylee. We noticed Jeremy was missing, too. So everybody in the house was looking for them. The bathroom door was locked. Well, Krista at first thought Kaylee had locked herself in the bathroom on accident.
Right.
So she banged on the door. Kaylee opened the door, opened the door. Well, we found out Jeremy was in there with her. He had gone through the trouble of locking both doors, the one that accesses the bedroom and the one that accesses the hallway. When he opened the door, Kaylee was laying on the floor with no pants on. And Krista asked him, what are you doing? And he said, well, I'm changing her diaper. But there was no diaper in the bathroom. And I don't know anybody that has to lock a door to lock a child, change a child's diaper. I have 8 kids of my own, and I've never had to lock the door to change their diaper.
No.
In the CPS reports later, they claim that Krista did say Jeremy had asked her for a diaper, but that was actually Jeremy's girlfriend they interviewed, not Krista, and Krista never said that. She did say he definitely did not have a diaper. So later on the Dr. Phil show, Dr. Phil does ask him about that incident, and he said he did have a diaper in a garbage bag behind the toilet.
Now, we'll get to more about the show later and the polygraph examinations and all that sort of stuff. Attorney James Boardman, there is a hearing coming up on January 6th regarding this case. What can you tell us?
Well, what happened subsequently with both Krista and with Jeremy, Kaylee's mother and father, Krista kept taking Kaylee to doctors. Because Kaylee kept saying things like, Daddy touched my pee-pee, Daddy put a fork in my pee-pee, Daddy said there was food in my pee-pee, and he had to eat that out of my pee-pee. She kept going to doctors. Doctors would contact CPS, or she would contact CPS, and there were investigations. The first investigation that precipitated from the birthday party incident, DHS, I'll use DHS, Department of Human Services in Michigan, and CPS, Child Protective Services, kind of interchangeably,
okay,
for the same department. CPS did an investigation and found that there was a preponderance of evidence that sexual abuse had occurred. During subsequent reports, when Krista kept going back to doctors, going back to CPS, they said that they never re-acknowledged that there was sexual abuse, but now they had a psychologist who said that Kaylee was being over-interviewed, over-exposed to doctors, and that if this kept going on, that she might start believing false memories.
Mm-hmm.
That was their words. That's in their report. And after about, I believe, about 6 months, they put both Jeremy and Krista on what's called the Central Registry for mental abuse of Kaylee. Now, the Central Registry is a registry where CPS has the right to put people without any judicial involvement if they feel that there's a preponderance of evidence a 5149 evidentiary standard that that something has happened, and educators can access that registry. Police departments can access that registry. Psychologists can access that registry. The Boy Scouts and Girl Scouts and organizations such as that can access that registry to see about the fitness of people to involve themselves with children.
Right. No, the... Again, going back to the website, and of course I encourage all my listeners to go to momsforjustice.org. Part of it is the, obviously the disclosure from the child, but the arrest of the father. What's the disposition of those charges?
I didn't quite finish what you asked me before. You asked me what the court case was on Tuesday.
Sure, yeah.
The court case is asking... an administrative law judge to take Krista off of the central registry. She has a right to request that. There's an evidentiary hearing, and the administrative law judge makes a determination. There have been subsequent charges with Jeremy Park, and Jeremy Park was charged with 9 counts of child pornography, which was found on his computer and in his residence. And there was a plea bargain that was worked out to where he pled to 2 charges of child pornography.
And illegal use of a computer.
Right.
He spent some time in jail. He's on probation now. He'll be on the sexual offenders registry for the rest of his life. And even in light of that, the Department of Human Services in Michigan says they're not going to change their mind that Kaylee was over-interviewed, that Krista took her to too many doctors, and that that was mental abuse.
Well, that's absolutely disgusting. Joe Jordan, one term that I see and I've heard about not only in this case but other cases is something called the incest loophole. Let's talk about that. What does that mean?
Well, before I get into that, I'd like to say that, in relation to the child pornography charges, recent research by the American Prosecutors Research Institute, they conclude that there is a correlation between individuals who collect and disseminate the child pornography and those who sexually molest children.
Absolutely.
It's just something that needs to be looked at in this case and others. As far as the incest loophole, this is by Andrew Vox, and excuse me, hold on 1 second here.
It's okay. If you're just tuning in, we're talking about Kaylee Rain and her story. Go to momsforjustice.org. That's momsforjustice.org to learn more about it. And in particular, watch the clips from the Dr. Phil show.
I'm sorry about that. But basically, with the incest loophole, they're basically saying that probation is available to these people because the law considers incest with a child to be a nonviolent crime. But the fact of...
Oh, God.
The physical force is rarely required for a parent to violate a child, and that does not make a crime nonviolent. Incest is most typically rape by extortion, with parents abusing their position to induce compliance from the victims.
Let's just back up a second, Joe, please. Who says that incest with a child is not a violent crime?
I'd have to look more deep into my research with that, but there are multiple. It really depends. There's so many people out there putting out information. There are independent therapists, there are independent psychologists, and it really comes down to who the experts are, and sometimes all of this information gets muddied and muddled.
Well,
and you don't know what is fact and what is fiction coming from fathers' rights groups.
Well, it's more than muddled and muddied. If anyone, I don't care what kind of PhD, or MOUSE or BS that they've got behind their name, if they're going to say that a child that is a victim of incest is not a victim of a violent crime, they're absolutely freaking nuts. And that
you, Dana. This is James Boardman.
Yeah.
I was involved in a case years ago where a probate judge said at a hearing where a 16-year-old had been raped by her father that he felt that counseling, because it was going to cost the county money, probably wasn't needed because she was 16 and probably would just get over it.
Oh, my God. Bonnie, again, as a grandparent, and we hear a lot of stories about grandparents and grandparents' rights, their grandchildren, they could see that their grandchild is living in an abusive relationship or they're being abused by the parent, whatever. But the grandparents in today's society have very little rights. You know, you need to be applauded and brought forward as a example of a grandparent who's doing the right thing to try and protect this precious little girl. This 2 years later, this must just be so heart-sickening for you to have to go through this. And I want to make this very clear for my audience. Is this child still seeing her father?
No, she has not seen her father since September 2007, and she is in therapy, but she definitely still acts out, and you can definitely tell she's still very much affected by what happened to her. But I have a 2-year-old child myself, so it was very hard for me to watch what Kaylee went through, because I kept thinking if it was my child, which being my grandchild felt like it was my child. I could not sleep, could not eat. I basically gave up my life for the last 3 years.
But there was a period of time where Krista did have to turn Kaylee over to him, correct?
Yes, and it was,
oh God,
a very devastating for her. She is mentally injured herself. She's 22 years old, and she is, I think, as much mentally injured as Kaylee is, because she carries around the guilt that she had to turn this child over, and she knew that Jeremy was going to be molesting her, and she carries around this guilt. Krista has lost, I don't know how much weight, but she's down to a size 4. You can see almost all the bones in her body. She cannot eat over this situation.
Another thing, this is James Boardman again, that should be stressed, that apparently the Department of Human Services chose to ignore, is that Jeremy was having sex when he was 21,
and Krista was 14.
Was 14 years old.
Jesus.
He abducted her, took her to Colorado without her parents knowing where she was, and had her living in a tent for approximately 2 months, I believe, where nobody knew where she was.
Yeah, I had reported her missing, and I had everybody out looking for her. I was calling different states. I knew Jeremy was most likely the one that took her, but all of her friends were saying, no, it wasn't Jeremy. She hitchhiked the ride to Jeremy's mother's house. So I called Colorado police, because I knew Jeremy's mom lived there, and asked them to be looking for her, and they did find her in a tent in a park at 14 years old with this 21-year-old creep hiding her out.
And he was allowed to plead to assault, simple assault charges.
You know, I was just
arrested for kidnap or anything.
I was just about to ask you, Counselor. It seems like the system has totally failed in this case with plea bargains, with I'm going to call them Big Brother, the Child Protection Services, whatever you want to call them. But Big Brother seems to have this power that maybe in some cases works, but in this case certainly didn't work. And here you have a mother now that is, I'm going to use the term trying to clear her name. Maybe that's not correct. But how has this system, and I want to get into the law enforcement aspect a little bit too, if you can speak about that. The system obviously has failed this family. How can the system be challenged now to make amends and make sure this doesn't happen again?
Well, a couple of things. Number one, there is, pending legislation in the Michigan Congress that no one can be put on this central registry without having been adjudicated to have been negligent or abusive by some court of law, by some judge. It can't just be a social worker who works as a DHS worker that can make that decision as it is now. So that I'm hoping that legislation passes, and that's good legislation. Additionally, there has to be some mechanism where what a child says can be admitted into a court of law. And what happened in this case is any time that we brought up what Kaylee had said,
or hospital records,
or anything like that, the judge would say that that's hearsay.
Yeah.
He wouldn't hear that. Now, I understand that by the rules of evidence. That's correct ruling by the rule of evidence. But I think that in this case, there's been a heck of a disparity between what's right and what, by the rules of evidence in Michigan, is just. The judge in one case let the friend of the court investigator cross-examine Krista. This lady's just she's an investigator, but she has no right to stand before the court as an officer of the court.
Right.
And the judge allowed her to cross-examine
and to act as the father's attorney because he didn't have one present. So the judge actually let the friend of the court worker object to evidence for Jeremy, including the hospital record showing Kaylee had a torn labia while she was with the father. There is one thing I want to bring up.
Sure.
With something the attorney said, where they put Krista on the national registry for taking her to therapists over interviewing.
Jeez.
I want to make it very, very, very clear. Krista took that child to two therapists. All the rest of the interviewing was done by CPS. They initiated it. They said you have to take her here and you have to take her there. And they also charged Krista with the times that Jeremy took the child to the hospital, which was two or three times himself. He took her in because her labia was torn in the middle of the night. They charged Krista with bringing her to the hospital when Krista wasn't even there. He had the visitation at the time.
Yes.
And I want to make that very clear. She was, and anything that I did, she was charged with. Everything I posted on the internet, they charged Krista with. When Krista did not have anything to do with the website, it was completely mine.
As a final resolution, what CPS did and what the court did was, rather than take the child, they told Krista they were going to take the child away from her and possibly her, at that time, unborn child and one other younger child.
Two.
Okay.
Other.
They said that she could not take the child to a doctor, she could not take the child to a therapist, unless there was an emergency, without first calling CPS and getting their approval.
Oh, my God. You know, and I'm chuckling because this is just, it's mind-boggling. I've dealt several shows, Counselor, you'll understand this this case, Crawford versus Washington, and the hearsay rule in court, where a young girl who actually died in a traffic accident before she could testify against her stepfather for sodomizing her, allegedly, and these people, you know, there just seems to be no justice. Joe Jordan, having a case like this and going to bat for a family, trying to help the best way that they can. Sadly, there's probably dozens and dozens of cases like this across North America, if not more. Again, we have a good system, but it seems like when it comes to protecting kids, the system fails. You have maybe overzealous social workers that aren't trained to make the judgments that they make, and somebody's life is ruined because of it. How do you, as an activist, as someone wanting to help, how do you cope yourself with something like this? And again, you need to be commended for trying to help too.
Well, Dana, it's really difficult trying to balance this and trying to help these families. But you know, if you look at the statistics, this is something that goes on a daily basis. It's believed that one in three girls is sexually abused, and the general consensus is that approximately one in six boys is sexually abused before age 16. You know, 15 million women in the U.S. have been involved in incestuous relationships. 33% of those victims are under the age of 6. 33% of those victims are 6 to 12 years old, and the other 33% are 12 to 18 years old. You know, we have a case we're working on now where the state of Michigan turned over two children to a registered sex offender. At the time they were turned over, they were 10 months old and 2 years old.
God.
Now they're 3 and 5. He was convicted of rape on an adult and then was allegedly raping a 4-year-old and was never convicted. He received custody after coming out of jail. And since then, authorities have had numerous other reports that the children are currently being abused, but the judge's secretary called the visitation center and told them not to make any more allegations against this registered sex offender. We have another case in Michigan where a child was left with a sexually abused father, and the mother's rights were terminated for reporting the abuse. And we're hearing from all over the country of reports that the children are being taken away from their mothers and being placed with the fathers accused of incest or child sexual abuse. And in many of these cases, evidence is being ignored by judges and CPS. And I think the problem really comes down to there are no checks and balances within these cases due to the secrecy allowed in the CPS cases.
Exactly.
You know, in other cases, children are being placed into foster care, and the state receives incentives by allowing these children to be adopted, even if their family can be saved or the children can be placed with a relative. There have been reports from other children that they're required to work in child care facilities for minimum wage. The problem is CPS needs a complete reform, and this is an agency that just should not be privatized. This is something that should be a government function, and we need people that are experts in this field and trained to handle these type of cases. That's all there is to it.
Bonnie.
I can't say the average. Many of the DHS caseworkers are fresh out of college, have no experience with children. Many of them are criminal justice graduates who would rather be police officers. And many of them that I have run into have huge psychological issues of their own.
Jeez, this is unbelievable. Bonnie, what's next for you and your family?
Repeat the question, I didn't hear it.
What's next for you and your family, Bonnie?
Well, I am meeting with the prosecutor this week, and I am going to go over all the evidence we have against Jeremy, and our hope is that Jeremy will still be prosecuted for sexually abusing Kaylee.
Well, it's not only should it be a hope, that it should be a desire. If the justice system is worth a damn, this jerk should be prosecuted. Bonnie, James, and Joe, stay in touch with me on this. I want to cover it some more, and unfortunately we're out of time, but I remind my listeners to go to momsforjustice.org for more information on this case. Thank you, guys.
Thank you,
Dana.
Okay.
Thank you, Joe.
Thank you.
Yeah, we'll talk soon. This case just is absolutely mind-boggling. And again, go to momsforjustice.org. Go through the whole website. Check out the video clips from the Dr. Phil show. Good on Phil McGraw for covering it the way he has. This case is a heart-wrencher for sure. We're going to be back in just a couple of minutes with Mark Williams with an update on the Kaylee and Casey Anthony case. And then a little bit later on, we're going to hear from, believe it or not, a Palestinian terrorist, a former Palestinian terrorist, Waleed Shubat, and he's going to talk about what's going on over in Israel and Gaza right now. My name's Dana Pretzer. This is the Dana Pretzer Show on Scared Monkeys Radio. We'll be right back.
It's the Dana Pretzer Show on Scared Monkeys Radio. And now back to the show.
All right, tonight we're going to join my friend Mark Williams. You know Mark is the news director at WNDB Radio, and he's a regular on the Nancy Grace Show to talk more about the Kaylee and Casey Anthony case. Mark, welcome back to the program.
Thanks a lot, Dane, and Happy New Year to you and all your listeners out there.
Yeah, same to you, sir.
Thank you.
This case continues on. We do have some breaking news, but what I want to get to you first with is the reported... what am I looking for? Immunity request from George and Cindy Anthony's lawyer before they talk to prosecutors. One normally doesn't ask for immunity unless one has something that they're worried about getting in trouble for. What's going on there?
I think we're just trying to muddy the waters a lot. Their new lawyer, from what I understand, is a straight shooter. But let me just preface everything that I say with... this is what Tim Miller said from Equisearch. Anybody that gets involved in this case gets body slammed.
Yep.
Okay?
Yep.
The deal is, it appears that he might ask for immunity. Well, my question in my mind as a reporter, why does George and Cindy need immunity?
Mm-hmm.
This is the woman who said that Casey's car smelled like there was a damn dead body in the back. And then she changed her story to it was only pizza. George has changed his story from investigators saying, yeah, I knew it was a body, it smelled like a body, to it was just garbage in the back.
Mm-hmm.
They have hindered this investigation from day one. The deal is they don't want to be charged with aiding and abetting Casey. And that's what it comes down to. They have given so many false statements to investigators and then have turned it around to say something else to the media that my head is spinning. As a reporter, and I'm going to take my hat off just for a second, Dana,
the best
thing that would ever happen, and this would make a great episode of Law and Order, is that when they're at the funeral for little Kaylee, is that they slip the silver bracelets on Cindy Anthony, because she has aided and abetted her daughter, not only this time, or not only over the past 6 months, but her entire life. They have had this woman get away with everything.
Mark Williams is here. Mark, have you ever covered a story like this? You've been in the business a long time.
No. I mean, I've covered a lot of things. I mean, too numerous to mention. And again, I thought this was going to be a 2 or 3 day deal, and it would be over with, and we'd be going to trial right now. This is not the case. She has not spoken. Casey has not spoken to anyone. We have found the remains of little Kaylee, and now there's two private investigators who allegedly work for the Anthonys on the side, but have also worked for Jose Baez in the past, and everybody is just trying to muddy up this situation. And Baez is trying to create doubt. My mind sometimes works in a strange way, and I'm thinking of the black helicopter, the old conspiracy deal, is that since both these guys have worked for Baez in the past, I wouldn't be surprised that if it ever came out with Baez saying, go out, muddy it up, do whatever you have to do, but we've got to get that one juror who has a doubt about Casey's guilt.
There's been plenty of talk, Mark, about change of venue.
Yeah.
There's been plenty of talk about Lee Anthony. Let's talk about those two subjects.
Okay, let's go with change of venue. Thus far, Jose Baez has not asked for a change of venue. Casey Anthony's trial expected to get underway in March. No date has been set. And he could ask for change of venue prior to that. He could ask for change of venue when the court opens up or when proceedings open up. Here's the deal. There's not too many places in Florida that has really not heard of this case extensively.
Exactly.
And I've written this in my Grace blog on WNDB.am, which I sometimes put up there. The deal is, the only two places would be St. Johns County, which is two counties over from Volusia. They're covered by Jacksonville Television and Orlando Television, and they're kind of an in-between market.
Mm-hmm.
And they get some television coverage of this, but not as extensive as we would here in the Orlando area. The second place to hold it is Oskaloosa County, up in the Florida Panhandle, which borders Alabama and is close to Pensacola. That would be the only other place, because I'm thinking people up there haven't heard of this case that extensively. Mobile television isn't covering the case, and neither is Pensacola, and it's 400 miles away from the heart of Central Florida.
And it's something that's maybe a last-minute motion by Baez, because any of the experts I've talked to say there's about as much chance of this case going ahead in March as there is me having an 80-degree day here up in Saskatchewan, Canada.
Well, and I think you hit it on the head, Dana. I don't think we're going to see any action in this case until late summer at the earliest. I mean, that is just my gut opinion, because there is just so much publicity on this case, as we call it in the media, pretrial publicity. And you talked about Lee Anthony. Lee was around, and he tried to pump some things, and you've all seen the videotapes from online.
Yep.
With Lee Anthony trying to pump his sister about information. He says he was going to start his own investigation. This guy is on it from another planet. He disappeared, and then he's back because he has to keep a job. And he's an events coordinator for a company that puts together concerts in parking lots. So he was out of town for a while. But I think he can end up getting charged with obstruction of justice as well. I think they all three could be in the Orange County Jail on this obstruction of justice charge. And here's another thing to take into consideration that's been put in the background. Even though Casey has been indicted, Dana, on a first-degree murder charge, she still has those theft charges hanging over her head.
Yep.
Which, if they could never get her on a first-degree murder charge, and if they come to trial with the theft charges from taking the checks and spending them that belong to her best friend, Amy Huizinga, that's 75 years in jail right there.
Yeah, Casey Anthony's not going to be getting out of jail anytime soon. If you're just tuning in, Mark Williams is here, and we're updating the Kaylee and Casey Anthony case. One last question, Mark. Dr. G, here's a gal that's going to be put on the hot seat. It's a place that she hasn't been on before, I'm sure, and she's going to be able to handle herself very well. But let's talk about Dr. G a little bit, inform my listeners about who she is. Of course, she has her own television show. Seems like everyone has their own television show except you and me. down there, but let's talk about Dr. G.
You know, I've never met Dr. G. She's been in Orange County for a couple of years. She's the medical examiner in Orange County, very well respected, very well educated. But I think even this Kaylee Anthony case has gotten to her.
Yeah.
For example, when she announced the findings of it's Kaylee Anthony, she died by homicide, but we don't know how she died.
Yep.
There was no blunt force trauma, no nothing like that. You know, even she, I think, was taken back by it. I think she's caught up in the emotion.
Yep.
Of the deal. I thought she almost broke because this case has affected everyone, from Dr. G to the sheriff, and even yours truly.
Mm-hmm.
who's a grizzled veteran and puts a lot of things off on the side, like, okay, I've seen this before. Let's move on to the next thing. I saw a picture of Kaylee Anthony on one of the Nancy Grace shows that she did around Thanksgiving, the first 30 days, and in the end they have Kaylee singing.
Mm-hmm.
that infamous piece of tape of her singing for her great-grandfather.
Yep.
And it put a lump in my throat.
Well, it choked you up.
Brought a tear to my eye, because yep. this is really, really, really a tough case. We're talking about a 2-year-old girl that was obviously murdered by someone who didn't care about a life whatsoever.
Well, you used the Tim Miller quote that anyone that gets involved in this case gets body slammed, but
oh, yeah.
There's only one person, allegedly, who is responsible for the death of this child, and courts will determine what happens to her. Just before I let you go, Mark, what's coming up next week in this case? Are we going to hear any, Nancy Grace loves to say breaking news or bombshell, that sort of stuff, or is it just going to be the same old, same old?
Well, here's the other thing. The monkey wrench has been put into the deal. This one private investigator by the name of Jim Hoover, who claims that he went back there in that same area and shot videotape in November, mid-November, and he claims there was no bag, there was no body there, is holding a news conference on Monday. It's going to be interesting to see what he says, because all the reporters in Orlando are very sharp, and they're going to take him to task, because somebody's lying here, and we don't know who it is. And, you know, with everybody, with their private eyes and everybody else, they have just muddied this case so much. It's not a cut-and-dried case anymore, as we thought it was going to be, Dana.
No, No, far from it, and it's going to be talked about for quite some time. Mark Williams, thank you, sir.
You're welcome, anytime.
We'll talk again soon.
You bet.
Bye-bye. Yeah, this case is far from being over. The PI, I think, is full of BS. But what's going to happen, I think, is even after the news conference, is the speculation will start to spin. The conspiracy theory people will be out there. Remember, we haven't seen the whole case. We haven't seen all the I's dotted and the T's crossed. It's being worked on for sure. And even though this dopey PI is going to come forward, that doesn't mean that the case is over. It's changed or it's different, but it is certainly something we're going to continue talking about. This is the Dana Pretzer Show here on Scared Monkeys Radio. We'll be right back. Okay, we're back. This is the Dana Pretzer Show. After months of having rockets fired by Hamas militants into civilian neighborhoods, Israel decided to respond with airstrikes on Gaza, and most recently, tanks and troops have been flowing into that area. Most people, listeners to this program, people across the world, do not really understand what this is all about. When you start talking about the Palestinians and Israelis and the conflicts that have gone on for a long time, no one really knows, except you hear the politicians talk about terms like Islamic fundamentalist radical talk, ideology. And when they start throwing out those $25 words, most people say, what is this? Well, former Palestinian terrorist Waleed Shobat joins me this evening, and he says that it's time for things to change, and it needs to start with the Palestinians. His new book, God's War on Terror, is available, and we have it in the show notes at scaredmonkeys.com. And it's a pleasure for me to have Waleed on the program. Good evening, sir.
Good evening. How are you?
Not too bad. You know, to preface and to start off the interview, when people do turn on the news, they see this conflict that's going on again, and they say, you know, either those Israelis or the poor Palestinians or what. Nobody really understands what's going on. You hear the politicians throwing out the big fancy words, the UN sitting down and talking about this, and the fundamentalist Muslims and the radical Islam and all that sort of stuff, but nobody really understands what's going on. Introduce yourself to my audience, and then let's get into this and let's talk about what it's all about.
I'm Waleed Shoaibat. I come from an American mother who wasn't permitted to leave the Middle East for 35 years. She visited the Middle East. She didn't realize that in the Middle East, American abducted wives and children who are brought in a Muslim country, if the father decides to keep them in that country, they will remain there indefinitely. So I grew up in the Middle East. From kindergarten all the way to high school, we learned the denial of the Holocaust. We learned the hatred of Israel. We sang anti-Semitic songs from a young age, from kindergarten. By the time I reached high school, the emphasis on martyrdom became prevalent in our education. The educators, graduates from Al-Azhar University of Egypt, with an ideology that comes from the Muslim Brotherhood, began to permeate the Middle Eastern education system. And of course, from social perspective, historic perspective, everything we learned, going to the local mosque, to the Temple Mount, learning from Ikrimah Sabri, the Supreme Muslim Council of Jerusalem, all these affect and basically molds the individual from a very young age to be anti-America, anti-Israel, and set and bent on the idea of martyrdom in order to have a salvation plan, if you will, that by the statements of the Prophet of Islam, that by the shedding of your own blood when you die as a martyr, not only you will enter paradise, but you become an intercessor for 70 members of your family. So it is a salvation message that permeated the culture, and this is why you have this, in essence, recruits millions of jihadists who are willing to die for the cause of Allah. It is an old story that basically when Islam was wounded in 1928, you had the birth of the Muslim Brotherhood. After that, the Wahhabists. So it began way before Israel's takeover of the Judea and Samaria, and way before the United States occupied Iraq. So this is an old story that's been brewing from the eons of time.
I was going to bring up Iraq. Most of the media coverage that we've seen lately has been about Iraq. The media coverage, whether it's mainstream media, cable news, the internet, of course, is a big picture now, newspaper. It's an education issue, and you talked about it. I'm going to use the term brainwashing. But when it comes right down to it, is it not an education issue here where people just don't understand what's really going on? You get one picture in the newspaper, and a lot of people believe it, and then all of a sudden those in Jerusalem, those in Israel, are being blamed for all of this?
Right. Well, the myth that permeates the West is that jihadism is an issue that is basically sparked as a result of occupation, frustration, the poverty. This is why they always argue the situation in Gaza, there's poverty, this recruits terrorists. Some think it's a psychological issue. Some think it's an isolated issue. This is an isolated issue that the majority of Muslims don't support this kind of teaching. All these things, you know, that goes in the airwaves in the West.
Mm-hmm.
In reality, will be considered obsolete once Westerners begin to go to the East, listen to the radio or Al Jazeera television, or watch the TV, the airwaves in the Middle East, you get a satellite dish and watch the programs. First of all, you have to understand Arabic as well.
Of course.
If you go to the first 100, let's say, websites in the Arabic language, that is, of Islamic websites, okay? We're talking about religious websites.
Sure.
If you go to the Islamic websites, go to all of them, what will you find in the Arabic language? You will find that the real view of Islam by the majority of Muslims, of course, that Islam is spread through peaceful means or through war, that America will fall under the Islamic rule someday soon. You will find the favorites of the Quranic verses that are being shared are all call for jihad. In fact, if you go to 90% of the mosques in America, and this has been a study that's been done by ex-members of the FBI who went on to the mosques and began to look at the mosques here in America even, 90% of the mosques support the jihadist ideology. And what is this jihadist ideology? The jihadist ideology basically it corresponds to what the Prophet of Islam from ancient times said. I have been ordered to fight all nations till everyone says there is no God but Allah and Muhammad is his messenger. So it's a religious conversion through jihad, operation through force. It intends to subjugate all non-Muslim entities, nations, into making Islam and forcing Islam and Muslims to becoming the dominating power, and all non-Muslims become subservient to Islam. This is an old, ancient, basically, agenda that's never stopped. If you look at Islam, as I mentioned before, when Islam was wounded in 1924, when the Allies basically stopped the Ottoman Empire, the last caliphate in the Ottoman Empire, he had Kemal Atatürk, who basically established European lettering for the Turkish, and removed the hijab, and removed the Sharia law, because most Westerners think that Islam is merely a religion. In fact, no scholar in the world will disagree that Islam is not simply a religion, it is a constitution. It is a form of government. It is a political apparatus with a political system that wants to establish itself globally. Islam is not simply a religion. It is an expansion. It is Islamic imperialism. And this is why my argument still stands. Historically speaking, Islam was wounded, and 4 years later, the Muslim Brotherhood was born to reestablish the Islamic hegemony. This is why when you watch, let's say, Al-Muhajirun in England, which is a defunct terror organization in England, when
right.
you watch their leadership giving a speech in the streets of England, this is in England, in a Western country, the words of the speech should raise a question. The speech goes as follows, that the West came to know that Islam is the truth, that the giant of Islam will rise again. Now, what's the question? What is this word again doing in that phrase? if something that was wounded wants to revive itself. And this is why it began way before Israel's involvement in Judea and Samaria and the American involvement in the war in Iraq. Until Americans begin to understand this and begin to listen to what is said in the Arabic language, they will still listen to the Western airwaves that simply said that this is a small group, disenfranchised group, or simply we are fighting Al-Qaeda. If we truly are simply fighting a terror organization, can anybody tell me, is Iran a terror organization or is it a terror state? Iran is the one that funnels all the monies and weapons to Hamas,
exactly,
to Hezbollah in Lebanon. What did Israel do to upset Iran? Israel never occupied Iranian territories. So, you know, one question and million questions that will prove the case beyond shadow of a doubt that the war has been declared on us and not vice versa.
Waleed Shobat's here. He's a former Palestinian terrorist. When did things change for you? I know you lived through and witnessed the Six-Day War. You were living in Jericho at the time. As things start to come into focus at that time, or when did things change for you?
Well, all terrorists that I know of that shed the mantle of hatred and terrorism from an Islamic background, all of them converted to Christianity. I, in 1993, began to examine the religious text of the Bible and comparing it with the Quran, thinking that I will find the problems in the Bible because all Muslims believe the Bible has been changed. In examining the biblical text, I ran into many things that astonished me, specifically the New Testament, where it says, where Jesus says, offer your body as a living sacrifice, not as a dead sacrifice. So it's a spiritual conversion. I do not need to die for Allah in order to receive salvation, because most Westerners don't understand why the Islamists insist on dying for the cause of Allah. Why not kill and get out of the situation? Why not just plant the bomb and leave? Why blow yourself up?
Right.
Because it goes back to the statement of Muhammad, that by the shedding of the martyr's blood, he will enter paradise and become an intercessor for 70 members of his or her family. In other words, it's a salvation plan that by you dying, you will enter paradise. This recruits a tremendous amount of jihadists. So until we begin to understand that in the West, that this is a salvation issue, we will never get to the crux of the whole issue. Second of all, I began to study the Holocaust in 1993. In which I began to recognize that the Holocaust was not a fabrication. In fact, any Westerner could check the record and to see that even the so-called moderate Mahmoud Abbas, the leader of the Palestinian, in his graduation, he wrote a thesis denying the Holocaust. Mahmoud Ahmadinejad denies the Holocaust. In fact, no Westerner will find any books in any library in the Middle East or the Muslim world that teaches any reality about the Holocaust. Mm-hmm. This all is kind of denied, in which they blame either Hitler, and they say he's a Christian, or they say this is not something that the Muslims did. When in fact, my grandfather's friend, Haj Amin al-Husseini, who was a regular guest at my grandfather's house, collaborated with Hitler on the eve of the Final Solution. Everybody can see the picture. Most Westerners don't even know that two divisions out of the Nazi war machine, the Khanjar division and the Albanian division, were Muslim SS soldiers. So two divisions out of eight divisions collaborated with Hitler to destroy the Jews in the Middle East. I began to realize that what I learned when I was young, that this is a fabrication, was not a fabrication, it was a reality. So I began to identify with my enemy's quest and my enemy's pain. I began to love my enemy. So by the time I began to speak out and began to fight terrorism, the media began to call me. You can see articles in the New York Times, you know, other articles, publications, blogs. The media began to call me to say that I was a racist, Islamophobic, divisive, bigoted, fundamentalist, Bible-thumping Christian. So I learned that, and I took that as a badge of honor.
I would say, if you're just tuning in, Waleed Shobat is here. His new book, God's War on Terror, is available, and we have a link to how to purchase it in the show notes. I think this is as good a time as any. Let's talk about the book. what brought you to write the book, Waleed?
I'm sorry. What brought me to write the book was I began to see when I became Christian, and I began to walk into churches, and I began to see Western interpretation of eschatological views and what have you. You know, there's many interpretations of the Bible. And I began to recognize there was something interesting about the Bible. And I began to see that what Christians call Antichrist in the Bible, you know, they recognize this Antichrist by him establishing 7 years of peace. Well, I knew as a Muslim that the Muslims talk about the coming of the Mahdi. In fact, the Mahdi is no longer a theory. You have Ahmad al-Nijad, even in speaking to the United Nations, talking about the ushering of this Mahdi.
Yeah.
And the Muslims will recognize this Mahdi when he ushers forth 7 years of peace. So in other words, what the Muslims and the Islamists believe is their Messiah, in fact, from the biblical perspective, is Antichrist. So I found it very interesting, and I began to investigate further. So I documented probably the largest compendium ever done in history on the views of Western Christians as well as Islamists regarding this eschatological view, because you must understand that the Islamists' views of attacking Israel and what have you, and the reason Muslims are declaring war on the West and Israel, has something to do and is linked to the eschatological education that Muslims receive everywhere in the world, mm-hmm. in every mosque. Even amongst the so-called moderates of Muslims, they teach these things. When the Muhammad, the prophet of Islam, he said that the day of judgment shall not come to pass until the tribes of Islam defeat the tribes of Israel. And then the trees will cry out and the stones will cry out, "There is a Jew hiding behind me. Come, O Muslim, come, O servant of Allah, come and kill him." In other words, Islam, in its eschatological views, have defined a final solution to this Jewish issue and to the return of the Jews to the land of Israel. In this, most Westerners need to begin to understand that mindset. I also written several books on the subject. Written a book titled Why We Want to Kill You, a secular book, in which I document the misconceptions in the West and the myths that the West harbor regarding this, that only 1% of Muslims believe in these things.
Right.
When in fact, the Pew did statistics in which over 50% of Pakistan, Jordan, North Africa, the Palestinians, Egypt, Syria, you know, over 50%, even amongst so-called moderate Muslim countries, they support Al-Qaeda. This is why when you see a terror attack in Mumbai, you know, you would think that you would have demonstrations by the millions in the Muslim world denouncing them. Yet the opposite is true. You will find 20,000 Egyptians, you know, this is, we're talking about regular community. We're not talking about terrorists or Al-Qaeda operatives.
Right.
We're talking about Muslims in the regular community go berserk in attacking Christians. And this is the issue that is very rarely spoken about in Western circles in the media. Nobody talks about the persecution of the Assyrian Christians in Iraq, or the persecution of the Coptic Christians in Egypt, or the persecution even of the Palestinian Christians in Gaza. Everybody talks about how Hamas is suffering, but nobody talks about the suffering of the Christians in Gaza by the hands of Hamas. So I began to see that there is a double standard here and a silence that needs to be awakened in the West.
And the silence that needs to be awakened is so accurate, and the education that needs to be done. Let's go back to September 11th, 2001, when the term war on terror was somewhat coined, although it had been around for some time. The liberal-dominated media in the West talked about this is all about oil, and it's got a lot more to do than just about oil. How does September 11th, 2001 play into all of this?
Well, 9/11 basically is an issue that concerns Americans alone. The denial of the 9/11, if you take statistics even in Kuwait or Marrakesh, that hey, it wasn't even Muslims who even carried out this terror attack. Mm-hmm. You've seen celebrations in the streets in the Middle East celebrating the death of 3,000 Americans. rarely ever viewed on the airwaves in the United States of America. By far, the majority of Muslims in the Middle East supported the attack and supports Al-Qaeda, as I mentioned, the Pew Research. In fact, 113,000 Muslims across the board in the Middle East were surveyed, asking them during the elections of the Palestinian election, in which our president insisted that we must have democracy and we must allow elections in the Palestinian areas, in which the entire Palestinian community supported Hamas. You had 73.2% support Hamas over the PA, which was considered by the West is a moderating factor, when in reality is not moderate whatsoever. So the volume of this agenda is a huge. It's much bigger than anybody thinks, and the facts on the ground proves these points. Just take a look. Take a look at all, you know, when the Pope made a speech.
Right.
He said Islam must not be spread through violence. The Muslim world went berserk, went ballistic. How dare the Pope make such a statement? Does he not know that Islam is a religion of peace?
Mm-hmm.
Yet they expressed this peace through sheer violence.
Yeah.
So it's an oxymoron to say that Islam is a religion of peace, yet express this peacefulness of Islam through sheer violence. No scholar in the world denies that Islam spread with its system through sheer violence, through jihad operations, even all the way to Spain. So Westerners are oblivious to the reality of the history of Islam. And a nation that is oblivious to its history will tend to repeat the same mistakes. Most Americans are unaware. When the song is sang that says, from the halls of Montezuma to the shores of Tripoli. What's this song with the shores of Tripoli?
Yep.
This is an old song. This was way before America occupied Iraq.
Absolutely.
It was way before this Israeli Hamas fiasco. What was going on there? Why would America would have to pay taxes? They used to have to pay taxes in order to allow their ships to go through the Mediterranean. And finally, America, the United States, decided to have a war and create the Navy. That was the purpose of the creation of the American Navy and the Marines, was to fight Islamic jihadists.
Yep.
So Americans need to look at their own history and how well connected it is with that war. Americans didn't occupy anything. The aggressor at this point was the Muslims when they forced the taxation. The majority of the taxes used to have to go to the Muslims.
Waleed Shobetz here. Last question for you, sir. Barack Obama will be inaugurated in a few days. He's making all sorts of promises. The world, or at least the world media, is saying that change is around the corner. Will there be much change with Barack Obama in charge?
I don't think so. I think, like Bill Clinton, they will attempt to build a legacy. And the way they want to build their legacies is by enforcing a peace that only Israel will keep, and Hamas will not keep, neither the Islamists will keep any peace resolution. Why? Because most Westerners are unaware that within the Islamic edict, Islamic nation can never have an everlasting peace legally from an Islamic legislative perspective. They can never have an everlasting peace because in Islam, the agenda is to Islamize the world. So this goes contrary to this agenda. In Islam, you are allowed to offer what is called a hudna, H-U-D-N-A. Every American should Google this word and begin to understand it. It is a ceasefire treaty. It could go up to 10 years, but must be broken before the ending of that treaty. Why? Because it goes against the Islamic religion. This is why when you see Yasser Arafat, who some think was simply a secularist, when he preached in a South African mosque, he said that we have the Treaty of Hudaybiyah, in which he gave the example of how Muhammad himself broke the treaty, that he intends to break his treaty with Israel in Oslo. In other words, while the West thought it was the Oslo Peace Accord, we called it the Oslo Hudna Accord. That's why the West needs to kind of stand in the shoes of an Eastern Muslim and to begin and view the world from a perspective of the Eastern Muslim. And this is why I present in my book, Why We Want to Kill You, all these Western misconceptions and how we can defeat terrorism once and for all.
The new book is called God's War on Terror. Waleed, thank you, sir. You're welcome here anytime.
Yes, sir. Thank you.
Take care. Bye-bye. And that comes right from the mouth of a former Palestinian terrorist, and Waleed Shobat is one who is very knowledgeable when it comes to this. This is the Dana Pritzer Show on Scared Monkeys Radio. We'll be right back. And we are right back, and I want to thank you all for listening this evening and remind you our webpage is www.scaredmonkeysradio.com. There you can pick up live shows, podcasts of past shows, daily commentaries, leave comments, whatever. And remind you that we'll see you again real soon here on Scared Monkeys Radio.
You've been listening to the Dana Pritzer Show on Scared Monkeys Radio. We invite you to discuss tonight's program with other listeners by joining us at scaredmonkeysradio.com, where you'll find program archives, links to tonight's guest websites, and further information regarding tonight's topics. Scared Monkeys Radio is a production of scaredmonkeys.com. Thanks for listening. We'll be right back.